everyone tuning in from around the world. My name is Cody Urban, talking to you from Portland, Oregon in the United States, and I am the auditor of the International League of People's Struggle.
Hi, Cody. Hi, everyone. Greetings from Manila, Philippines. I am Mensch, also from the International League of People's Struggle General Secretariat, and also your host for the People's Struggle podcast brought to you by the ILPS.
And the ILPS is an international united front organization of over 400 mass organizations in 45 countries and territories around the world. We bring together our organizations on shared analysis and action through conferences, publications, campaigns, and convergences that uplift our shared fights against the global imperialist system.
And of course, as we strive to foster greater solidarity and collective awareness across borders, we are thrilled to introduce this exciting new podcast series. So join us as we delve deep into the topic of imperialism, exploring its manifestations in our everyday lives. And of course, we are reminding our listeners that if you have any ideas or you think of any proposals of what you'd like to hear on our future programs, please email us at peoplespodcast@ilps.info, or you may comment down below the podcast and let us know your ideas.
You're listening to the People's Struggle podcast of the ILPS. In particular, our series, Media Militants, Unveiling Militarism and Imperialism in Mass Media.
That is right, Cody. Actually, we really quite had an interesting discussion last time. And specifically, we talked about how the longest aired show in the Philippines titled Ang Probinsyano was used by the Philippine government as a tool to reinforce the superiority of police and state forces, military forces in the country by, you know, using this specific formula of humanizing them and deliberately plotting narratives that would deflect the public from the government's anti-people and fascist policy. So we really had an interesting discussion last time. And now I am excited, Cody, to be talking with you about another format of, you know, media content that is also widely consumed, not just in the Philippines, not just in Asia, but also in the other countries. And I am interested also to know your insights, since I know you were a fan of this show.
That's right. So today we're going to be talking about one of my childhood favorite movie series, Godzilla. Science fiction and fantasy is sometimes that secret weapon that can get into our minds in terms of narratives that support the ruling system and support, in particular, militarism in this aspect. Fantasy is something that can't happen in the real world. I said in the last episode, like Lord of the Rings, or for science fiction, Marvel movies, where like they're superheroes. It's like none of this, it's assumed in our minds that there's never going to be superheroes. There's never going to actually be dragons and, you know, wizards fighting. And so it's easy to sit back, unplug, and escape a bit from the real world. But yep, the issue there, yeah, right? The issue is that we can forget that it is real world people who are writing these not so real world themes. And so who is writing the story still controls the message that gets into our minds with fantasy and science fiction.
So again, you were listening to Media Militants Unveiling Militarism and Imperialism in Mass Media. So let's get into the discussion of this film that is really widely appreciated, and also a lot of fans, even in my circles, Cody, my friends, my, you know, my classmates when I was in college, even in high school, and even some of my professors, there have been discussions, discourses, and even debates and theories about this show. So can you do the honors, Cody, of, you know, introducing to us the specific film show or film, sci-fi film that we are going to talk about today?
Godzilla has a very special place in history. And I do want to mention in particular that this episode, we're recording it the day before the 78th anniversary of the U.S. atomic bombing of Hiroshima in Japan. This, again, is the only time Or I would say one of only two times, because another one would drop on Nagasaki a few days later, that nuclear weapons were ever used against people in warfare. They were used by the United States. It's a very interesting time right now because we just saw this movie, Oppenheimer, that was released about the man who created the atomic bombs. And in watching that movie, do you get this message that it's ambiguous about whether it was the right decision of the United States to use the bomb or not? There's times that Oppenheimer himself in the movie even seems conflicted, saying, oh, like, was it a good idea? Was it a bad idea at the end? But it doesn't get the message across to the audience. It wants you to choose. And to have a movie that is ambiguous about that messaging, when the talk of nuclear war is more alive in our society than it has been in years, I think is very dangerous. If anything, this movie wants the message to be ambiguous so that when you turn it off and go watch the news, then the news will be the one to tell you, no, we still have to have nuclear weapons. So I think it's important for us to be very clear that from a movie or any kind of messaging that this decision did not have to happen. This was a deliberate move by the United States to come out as the main superpower by showing off the most devastating weapon possible, and it did not care how many people died. I'm saying that now because the movie Godzilla, this might surprise people, was actually an anti-nuclear, anti-war movie. Ishiro Honda was the director of the movie, and he served in World War II in the Japanese military. And on his way home, he passed through Hiroshima. He saw the devastation. He saw flattened buildings. He may have even had to walk by bodies, pile of charred bodies that are still being taken away for burial because there was just so much damage. And this left a searing impact in his mind. And he talked a lot about this in the years leading up to making the movie. This was big on his mind. And so when it came time to actually write the movie Gojira, which is actually a combination of the Japanese words for whale and ape, because Godzilla, you know, what looks like a giant lizard or a giant Tyrannosaurus, was actually initially thought of as a combination between a giant ape and a giant whale. So that movie Gojira, or how it was translated into English, Godzilla, was the result of Ishiro Honda's terror at what he saw coming through the ruins of Hiroshima. So as we start talking about this, Mensch, I know you said you were going to do your homework at the end of the last episode.
Right.
So why don't you tell us what you learned about Godzilla?
I took the time to research and learn about the history of Godzilla, and this might probably be a great starter for me to explore more science fiction shows starting today. And yeah, it's interesting also to note, like what you've said, that Godzilla was really a clear embodiment of Japanese fears about the nuclear weapons in the wake of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, right? So, which, by the way, these bombings will be commemorating them on their 70th anniversary this August 6th. And also to inform our listeners, the ILPS has released a statement on this. So going back to the topic, going back to Godzilla and what I discovered from my research, of course, it was a movie created 9 years after the World War II. And to me, it's really my initial reaction was, it's really a deeply political movie and also a social commentary. And it encapsulates that, like, the social fear of generations in Hiroshima, of the anti-nuclear sentiment that they have. And what's even more interesting is, up until today, that kind of anti-nuclear sentiment is very much alive in different generations in Japan. Interesting also to note that after the film Godzilla was shown, there was also a deliberate move on the part of the U.S. really to censor all Japanese media during their seven-year occupation and did not allow anyone to talk about the bombings publicly. And of course, it was released also 2 years after the U.S. occupation ended. And, you know, Cody, surprisingly, I found it interesting and had this realization that, of course, I need more shows like this in my system. And sci-fi films such as Godzilla, when you see it for the first time, you wouldn't really automatically realize the, you know, there are underlying political and historical contexts involved. So that's why when we talked about it during our first episode, I said I was not really familiar with the film, but I know that Godzilla was an iconic character. I hear it from the conversations of my cousins growing up and even some of my friends, and it really made a mark to a lot of people across the world, especially the young ones. But also we have to put focus also and emphasis on the underlying historical contexts and narratives that have been encapsulated by the different versions of Godzilla. And these are just some of the points that we need to unpack in today's podcast. And it's also interesting to know that you have laid down the historical, you know, background of Godzilla, and also how the life of the director himself was also portrayed and, you know, subtly explained in that film show. So yeah, I also want to learn more about how it came about and today, how the young ones are, you know, interpreting the different versions of Godzilla. Because I understand there have been a lot of succeeding versions, like added characters, added conflicts with different contexts, especially when it was already more popularized in the United States.
Sure. Well, let's first talk about that iconic character that you said, Godzilla. So when I was in Japan, which I had mentioned in the last episode that I was in Japan a couple months ago for the protests against the G7 summit, which we should probably tie back to that by the end of this episode. But I went by through Tokyo, and I went to outside Toho Studios. Toho was the company that produced the vast majority of the Godzilla movies. And at the top of the Toho building is a giant Godzilla head figurine that looks down at the city of Tokyo. So again, that iconic image of this giant monster just making his way through skyscrapers in the buildings. I mean, what other cooler image can you have as a young kid? For me, I saw this giant dinosaur looking thing with these big spikes on his back and can breathe blue nuclear fire. And I'm like, wow, that's amazing. And I got the different figurines. I got the toys. And like you said, Mensch, in subsequent movies, they would add in other monsters. Like one was Anguirus, who's a gigantic like ankylosaurus dinosaur with big spikes on his back and can leap off of buildings onto Godzilla. There's my favorite, Mothra, who's a giant moth who can shoot out silk and web that can catch Godzilla and other monsters in a web. So like I'm saying, right, this is science fiction. This is really cool. These are things that you can kind of sit back, relax, and have fun with. But remember that behind all of this, Godzilla is a giant monster, and one that humans have almost no effect on. The ways that humans fight back against Godzilla is they have to create these gigantic and almost like equally destructive military machines in order to get that across. So for this giant monster that looks cool to us from the other side of the TV screen, it's actually terrifying for the humans inside the TV screen. And it feels like there's almost nothing they can do about it. And for that, I want to bring us back to what Ishiro Honda saw as he was going through Hiroshima. Right when he was going through Hiroshima, he saw the effects of a giant monster that flattened an entire city in his country. For Honda, that monster was the atomic bomb. And like you said, Mensch, there was censorship throughout the U.S. occupation of Japan. No one could talk about the bombs, but there were other bombs being worked on that people also weren't allowed to talk about. So around this time that the movie was coming out in the mid-50s, the United States, instead of actually going along with the original UN, the United Nations, tried to pass a law that would dismantle the rest of the US's nuclear stocks for the bomb. And the United States refused to comply with it. That's what inspired the nuclear arms race that still continues to today. So the next level up in that nuclear arms race was the United States started testing hydrogen bombs. These are bombs that have massive amounts more energy than the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It was terrifying to watch these bombs detonate. And the United States was also occupying islands in the Pacific. In particular, there was one island called Bikini Atoll. And the U.S. evacuated all the people who lived around here. The people were told they would one day be able to go back home. Many of them never went back home. Others went back home, but were eventually irradiated, and generations down the line still suffer horrible cases of cancer. This is the nuclear forgetting that the U.S. has done over the effects that it has left communities in the areas it has tested as bombs. So you see, for Ishiru Honda and the people in Japan watching this movie when it came out, this monster of Godzilla was not this fun thing to watch. The monster that they could do nothing about reminded them of the exact monster that they were seeing the U.S. unleashing and other countries at the time as they were building up their nuclear stocks. So Godzilla seems like this fun movie to watch as he storms his way through, and we can cheer about how cool it is that he's stamping on tanks and fighting off against evil alien monsters. But in reality, Godzilla is a metaphor for one of the scariest monsters that has ever been brought into existence, and that's nuclear weapons.
Yep, Cody. And also it's important to note what you've said, like how Godzilla, the original film, has emerged and has been recreated to be, you know, we can say that it was recreated to be palatable to Western biases, right? So there have been discussions and arguments that would claim that there was a deliberate co-optation on the side of the US, and which is also in line with the developments now of the arms race, how it triggered conversations and policies supporting the nuclear arms race, despite the numerous generations of anti-nuke sentiments. And yeah, I also wanted to echo what you said a while ago, how the film that brought the Japanese director Honda and how it created wide attention. And although that time, the very first version, the original version of the Godzilla film was really a metaphor, and it was like the huge lizard-like monster. It was the result of the atomic radiation in the ocean, how it terrorized Japan. And, you know, the film really originally intended to alert the audiences to the dangers of nuclear war. And it was, although it was presented in a format that could be an escapist fantasy, and perhaps that was also the reason why through the years after that, it became immensely popular at the box office. And I also read somewhere that from the original Godzilla character in the first ever movie, the sequels and remakes in the US, of course, they got better graphics, they got better flares, but none of the political weight of the original movie. That's for sure. That's one of my main observations. And there also have been discussions that, aside from being, you know, dominantly a science fiction show, how most people view it, it's also being created or presented rather as a horror movie or with that kind of trope, since Godzilla, it's the personified terror of the bomb. So these giants also became symbols of disruption. And like what you said, when it was already mainstream in the other countries, especially in the US, the film was made available in rental outlets, of course, most notably the Blockbuster. And it's, you know, it's a progression over the series' previous releases. And of course, the storyline was inventive, the acting altogether, the special effects. They really put a lot of budget under, you know, millions of budget for that. and a lot of DVD offers from the original Japanese soundtrack. But of course, when it was followed by the, you know, number of sequels and was remade in the United States, it was released in North America, winning praise from critics who had never seen Godzilla in its original form. So that's why I feel very strong for that argument or for that sentiment, how it was really co-opted. And it was a deliberate move also that would, you know, deflect the real issues and the historical context and how it triggers nuclear arms race, and very evident with how, you know, how today's world, rich countries, powerful countries are reconfiguring to push for these policies for their benefit and for their dominance in different parts of the world.
That's right. And it was actually co-opted in a very sinister way, in that when the first 1954 movie was released in the United States, it was dubbed over. And so you had American actors who were giving different voices to the Japanese actors. And so they could really say whatever they wanted to say and make it sound like that's what the Japanese characters in the movies were saying. So the first part of it that was really co-opted was that, like you said, Mensch, it was almost a horror movie. You don't see Godzilla at first. Instead, what you see is all these Japanese fishing boats disappearing or exploding in the ocean. And it's almost like a mystery. It's like, what's happening? There's something in the ocean. And it's not until maybe halfway through the film that you actually see Godzilla emerge on land as this giant creature mutated by nuclear testing. And that is in reference actually to real Japanese fishers who caught wind of the fallout from those hydrogen bomb tests I was talking about and got cancers. And that was a thing that the US was also trying to keep hidden. They wanted as few references to those real life instances of their military testing happening. And so they took out a lot of those scenes that were deliberately put in there for that reason. And then when they had the dubbed version speaking over, they took out very deliberate quotations from the movie. I just want to read some of these quotes from the movie that were taken out in the American version. One says, "Oh, I barely escaped Nagasaki, and now this," when Godzilla appears. "Godzilla is no different from the H-bomb hanging over Japan's head." Again, directly pointing to the US, Britain, and French hydrogen bomb testings happening in Japan's backyard, pretty much in the Pacific Ocean. "To put it simply, hydrogen bomb testing has driven Godzilla from its habitat." That's what one character says when he's testifying to the government. And the biggest one is right at the end, where after Godzilla has been killed, he says, "If nuclear testing continues, then someday, somewhere in the world, another Godzilla may appear." That was the message we were supposed to leave Godzilla with. That if nuclear testing continues, we're going to see more of these monsters. And the United States totally took it all out. They just wanted you to see a flashy, fun monster movie. And to add insult to injury, they added in extra scenes with the flashy 50s actor Raymond Burr, who could be the American voice who is translating all of this to an American audience, in sort of this dashing and very kind of, you know, American-centric kind of way, in a kind of a racist way, in that it thought that that would be the only way that American people would want to watch a Japanese sci-fi film. This is very deliberate. It's very on purpose that this happened. And throughout the years, the ways that Godzilla turned into just a fun monster movie, which I'll admit I had so much fun watching the ones where Godzilla is fighting space aliens and there's like side romantic relationships that you're seeing develop of the human characters. It totally took out the anti-nuclear, anti-war feel of it. But the worst came just a few years ago when Godzilla, the United States released Godzilla, King of the Monsters. It was again, like you were saying, manage some of the biggest computer graphics. And there's King Ghidorah, the three-headed dragon from outer space, and shooting lightning from his mouths. And as fun as it is the polar opposite of what Ishiro Honda tried to get across in Godzilla. In the first Godzilla in 1954, Godzilla is destroyed by another very destructive device created by Dr. Serizawa, a scientist, called an oxygen destroyer. It literally sucks all the oxygen out of the water. And then he kills himself and burns all of his records about how to make it because he never wants it to be made again. That was the message, that nuclear weapons should never be used again. Well, in Godzilla King of the Monsters just a few years ago, the humans realize they need Godzilla to fight back against the evil space monsters. And so when Godzilla almost dies, guess how they bring him back? They go to the bottom of the ocean and they detonate a nuclear bomb. And because Godzilla feeds off nuclear energy, the nuclear bomb brings Godzilla back to life, and he rises triumphantly out of the ocean with this big roar. And all the humans cheer as he's going. And it's military. All the military are cheering as Godzilla goes to fight the evil space dragon King Ghidorah. So we went from 1954, where nuclear weapons are shown as the worst monster ever, should never be used, all the way to I think it was 2019, when King of the Monsters came out, where the nuclear weapon saves the day. The nuclear weapon brings Godzilla back to life. This is the biggest slap in the face that U.S. imperialism could give to all the people who were massacred in the nuclear bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
And I couldn't agree more, Cody. It's like a 360-degree turn, right? It's also how U.S. twisted the Japanese anti-nuke narrative in the original Godzilla film. And it's very Western, if you may, how these producers, filmmakers who created the subsequent Godzilla films, inserting many different new elements, new characters, graphics and animations. It's really a covert plot. And, you know, from that years-long anti-nuclear sentiment or point of view to the dangers of sweeping the historical trauma, the collective trauma of the Japanese people who have experienced atomic bombings, actual atomic bombings. And it's so dangerous and frustrating at the same time how we went on from Godzilla as a metaphor of that collective trauma, of that anti-nuke sentiment. Millions, thousands of people have been victimized by the atomic bombings by the U.S. And now how it has been twisted in a 360-degree turn into a militaristic propaganda or narrative. And it's also interesting to note how these developments, how the progression of the Godzilla and the films and the versions that followed after that is also in line. It went hand in hand with the developments also of how the Japanese government relates to the U.S. government until today. We all know there have been a lot of developments when we talk about militarism and wars of aggression instigated by the U.S., how it reconfigures its power, political and military power. And with Japan, who have a lot of generations of victims of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings, now working hand in hand with the U.S., with the policies that are bordering and also directed at driving to the push of policies that would support nuclear arms race. And it's very frustrating. And you were right when you said it's like a big slap in the face, especially when you talked about the experience in the recent G7 Leaders Summit. They really held that summit in Hiroshima, and they even had the, you know, the world's richest leaders even had the gall to visit. They had the gall to have that deceptive visit to the atomic bomb museum in Hiroshima. And this G7, it's called the Group of Seven. It's an alliance of the world's richest countries, and who are, you know, consolidating their powers. It's a powerful alliance of the West, which is led by the U.S. until today. And it, you know, it pushes away and deliberately neglects the grim consequences of the US-led nuclear warfare and militarism, and which these policies, these have continued to threaten the people's quest, the hunger for just peace and their own liberation. It's also very timely that we are about to commemorate and remember all the victims who have perished in that Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombing. It was in August 6th, right, during the World War II. And it's really a collective trauma. And when we talk about the bombings, we not just talk about like remembering or not just being in solidarity with the people of Japan who are until today seeking for justice, but it's also a warning. It's a sign for the rest of the world, especially the vulnerable countries, you know, to have a more strong solidarity and resistance against these mechanisms that are instigated by the US and its consolidation of power with other powerful countries. And it's very much alive until today, these policies that would continue to pose threats of wars of aggression and militarism in poor countries. And I feel so much for this, especially since I live in the Philippines, which is very, you know, it's part of a very strategic region. And we all know now the US is shifting its policy towards Asia. And there have been military agreements in place to secure its dominance over the region. So we should be, you know, having more conversations on this, how this sentiment of anti-militarism and anti-wars of aggression led by the US would affect the daily lives of ordinary people, especially those in the global south and the poorer countries.
I think I'm starting to understand who the real monsters are.
Right?
just like what I was referring to from 2019 in Godzilla, King of the Monsters, when Godzilla himself is brought back to life by that nuclear weapon detonated and then comes out of the water and starts fighting. I think that is the symbol of what happened when the nuclear bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. Those nuclear explosions inaugurated this new era of US military dominance. But just like in Godzilla, throughout the years, other monsters are born and strengthened throughout the years. And when you're talking about Japan, Japan for decades was not allowed, its constitution did not allow an offensive military posture. Its military were only called defense forces. It was illegal for Japanese military to have any kind of military operation outside of the borders of Japan. And it was only just a few years ago that Japan changed its constitution. There's been rising militarism and rising nationalism. And one could almost say it's of a neo-fascist fervor, just like before World War II, which was around the same echo of what was happening in the United States with this big neo-fascist uprising that led to the election of Donald Trump. And so around the same time, Japan changed its constitution so that its military could be offensive. And since then, that was Shinzo Abe who passed that. And the current prime minister, Fumio Kishida, actually used that to pass broad sweeping military expansion policies. So just last year, Japan joined South Korea at the NATO summit in Spain. NATO is a North Atlantic, it stands for North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Japan and South Korea are nowhere near the Atlantic, and yet they were still invited to come in to this new grouping of monsters, right? And they signed a trilateral military agreement with the United States. The Japan, US, and South Korea trilateral military agreement has created so much military expansion in the Indo-Pacific region. And currently, the US, Japan, and South Korea are doing very provocative military drills on the Korea Peninsula, actually practicing what it would look like to have a nuclear invasion of North Korea. That's how provocative this is. And what you're talking about with the Philippines, Mensch, Japan is talking about its own military agreement with the Philippines too, which of course would only slightly mirror the United States' own military agreement, which is incredibly unequal. It allowed U.S. unhampered access to the Philippine military facilities for so long. And now with the opening of new U.S., new bases, military bases in the Philippines for the United States to use, we're seeing more monsters line up. This commemoration of the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, I think, couldn't be happening at a more crucial time with the threat of another world war.
Yes, you are right, Cody. Talk about monsters. And it's also good that you have mentioned, aside from the G7 summit, the Group of Seven summit, we also have the NATO, which is also, you know, a manifestation of how US has been consolidating its militaristic influence in the other countries. And also, while you have mentioned the Philippines now, there is a revival of the bases. I have never, you know, when growing up, it was just new. It was just, you know, history to me that Philippines has been, you know, a location of US bases. But now I never imagined that this day would come, that I would be witnessing the revival of US bases in the country. And for the longest time, and also for all the records of human rights violations because of the existence of and the stay of the US bases and forces here in the Philippines, they've also added 5 additional bases to the Philippines. The Philippine government has earmarked millions, even billions of budget for this military exercises. But in actuality, the Philippines has been used by the US as a springboard of its military exercises. And also interesting to note how Japan now, with the development of these so-called reconfiguration also of these powers of rich countries, it's also struggling to rearm itself, no, veering away from that post-war pacifism in the face of what they call the immense external threats. And there, like what you've mentioned, Cody, there's a circumvention of its pacifist peace constitution, and it has been marred with mass demonstrations and even public outcry, as the Japanese government already deems nuclear weapons as better alternative than expanding the country's collective self-defense. And it has refused to ratify even their treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons, as they, of course, heavily rely on the U.S. nuclear umbrella provided through the alliance, of course, of the U.S. and Japan military. So this comprehensive alliance and patronage created by the U.S. over other imperialist rich countries also built its hooks of control on Japanese politics, economy, and military. And to fulfill its, you know, its agenda, Japan is now taking a crucial role in warmongering against other countries, especially with the growing power of China in the Asia Pacific region. And since we are already talking about military alliances, like what you said, the powerful countries are, you know, aligning themselves. And also Japan now is also eyeing for its participation in what we call the nuclear-powered collaboration through the AUKUS. So it's originally involved. There is Australia, the United States, and the United Kingdom. So when we talk about all these military alliances and we relate it to how Godzilla was originally created and how the narratives of the victims of that atomic bombings, and looking now at the developments of militarism and agenda of war of US and other rich countries, it's really important for us to have deeper discussions about this, since it's an alarm. It's a warning, especially to, you know, more vulnerable countries who might be victims also of these arms race.
That's right. And in terms of that arms race, what the monsters look like now, there are thousands of nuclear warheads armed and ready to launch around the world. The US and Russia, the two biggest holders, between the two of them have close to 12,000 nuclear weapons. The United States has nuclear weapons stationed at 20 different bases throughout the United States, as well as its own overseas bases in Germany, Italy, Belgium, the Netherlands, and even Turkey. This is how far the monster of the new U.S. nuclear posture goes. So to bring it back home, I think that we should remember who the real monster is. That's what Yoshiro Honda wanted us to do when he made this film in 1954. And this monster has never been more terrifying. It's never been more ready to unleash. But the message I want all of our listeners to leave on, because again, we were left with a message at the end of the original uncensored version of Godzilla, which is that, and I quote, "If nuclear testing continues, then someday, somewhere in the world, another Godzilla may appear." And so the message that I want to leave us on is that these monsters of imperialist powers who are gearing up for a catastrophic war might seem like it did. It might seem like it does when we watch these Godzilla movies, giant monsters fighting each other over the ruins of our destroyed cities. And they're so big, they're so huge, there's almost nothing that us tiny little humans can do except watch and root for the more powerful one. Because at least if only one survives, then there won't be a big fight. We'll just live under the shadow of a giant monster. And that's not what we have to do. All giant monsters have been defeated by the tiny little humans around them in these movies. And just like that happens, us tiny little humans are actually the most powerful force there could be. There's so many more of us who are critical of these, of this military buildup. There's so many more of us who are critical of imperialist maneuvers by the United States and other imperialist powers. I think that if we can look past that fear and see that our power can be greater than all of these powerful states and the companies that back them up, they will eventually be as afraid of us as we're afraid of Godzilla and other monsters. We have to organize. We have to reach new people. We have to show as many people as we can in all of our communities and all of our countries that there is a power to fight back. We are the Godzilla to U.S. imperialism. So let's organize. Let's build up the International League of People Struggle and other organizations around the world. And let's link our struggles together.
Beautiful. That was so beautifully put, Cody. And, you know, imagine we started off as, you know, talking about your fascination about Godzilla as a sci-fi film, as a horror film. And now we are talking about strengthening our international solidarity. And it's true what they say, that most of the time monsters are people, but it's even truer that the slayers of monsters are people coming together and fighting as one. So that was a very interesting discussion. But for now, we want to thank all our listeners for joining us today on another thought-provoking episode of the People's Struggle podcast on the complex relationship between militarism and mass media. So we hope that this podcast has provided you with valuable insights and a deeper understanding of how these forces intertwine in shaping our world today.
And I will also mention, as Menchi said before, definitely look at the recent statement released by the International League of People Struggle on the 78th and a commemoration of the U.S. nuclear bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Read that statement, and it's up on our website. And let us all hold in our hearts the memories of the people who were unnecessarily killed and use our rage at that to build our movement strong so that we can actively remember by building that movement. We hope you continue to tune in to our future episodes. It's great to have this platform to examine the intersections between imperialism, militarism, and mass media, and hopefully provided every one of us additional tools of analysis to understand deeper these narratives and types of content that we encounter and challenge the prevailing discourse about them.
That's right, Cody. And we hope you have enjoyed the program. Stay tuned for more engaging discussions and episodes. Please email us at peoplespodcast@ilps.info if you have comments, suggestions, and any questions about the program you have just heard. And also please send us suggestions about topics and struggles you would like us to address in the future podcasts. And you can find dates or updates for future episodes transcripts and recordings of this and other People's Struggle podcasts on the website of the ILPS and also on our podcast account. And the website is peoplestruggle.info and also on the official ILPS Facebook page.
Thanks, Mench. Once again, I am Cody.
And I am Mench, and this has been the People's Struggle podcast. Thank you, everyone.